Welcome to Awakening Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Anne, in October of 2007, Anne, who is a native of Denver, Colorado, and a nuclear engineer by profession, was waiting for a work permit in Spain, and that never came through. Instead of looking for other work, she decided to walk on foot along an ancient pilgrimage path from Lyon, Spain, to Santiago, which is known as Camino de Santiago. In the December of that same year, she began a longer pilgrimage from Canterbury to Rome, Italy, and ended up walking over 2,100 kilometers. The following winter, she decided to do it again, and this time from Germany to the Camino de Santiago in Spain, ending in Finisterre. In winter of 2009, you guessed it, you know, she walked again on another pilgrimage over 4,400 kilometers from Ukraine to Patras, Greece. And by this time, she was known as the Winter Pilgrim. She was being asked to give talks and share about her experiences with many, you know, different groups. One of the things that saddened her was sort of a slightly cynical comment where people would always tell her that, you know, sure, you can do something like this in Europe, but not in U.S. It's not in our culture. No one would open their door to a pilgrim. And to demonstrate that North Americans are just as kind, she set out on her next pilgrimage from Denver, Colorado, and walked down to the Basilica of Guadalupe in Mexico City. And lo and behold, she was right. She learned that Americans and Mexicans are just as friendly. In 2011, she walked again, and this was during the Arab Spring. She walked 6,300 kilometers from Santiago, Spain, through the North African Road to Jerusalem in Israel. In 2012, she ventured out to South America and started in Argentina and walked up along the eastern coast, crossing Chile, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Nicaragua, you know, all the Central American countries, and ended in Mexico City. That 1,300-kilometer journey took her almost a full year. And as you can guess, there's no chance of her slowing down. The following year, she walked from Helsinki to Rome, then from Denver to Quebec, spanning 44 countries over the 9 years. This 52-year-old has walked close to, it sounds like about 40,000 kilometers from my calculations, and that's about 25,000 miles. As she walks, she doesn't carry any money, cell phone, or a camera. In fact, she's calling us right now from a friend's cell phone, Nicole, who's a part of the Awaken Call team. And we're really fortunate to catch you in between your pilgrimages. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks so much. I'm glad you were able to make it. I know you were walking on foot to Nicole's house this morning.
Yes, of course.
You cannot take the pilgrim out of out of regular life.
Right.
I'm gonna jump right in because I feel like, you know, there's a lot to cover today. I want to start with the with the obvious. Why pilgrimage? What makes you leave the comfort of your home, you know, at the height of winter, almost all the time, and motivates you to walk thousands of miles?
You know, walking in winter, I'll just dispel that now, is so much better than walking in summer, or walking in the cold than walking in the heat. Because the colder it is, the more clothing I wear, the less I have to carry in my backpack. So I'm really, at the bottom, a lazy pilgrim. I don't want to carry much. The colder it is, also, the faster I walk. So, you know, the days are usually very short in winter, so I get to where I'm going quicker, and then I have more time to speak with people. Additionally, the lakes are frozen. I can walk right across them. Everything is very clean. It's not muddy or dirty, dusty in the air. The vegetation is down, the leaves off the trees, the grasses are down. I can see so much further. There are no mosquitoes. There are no snakes. Bears are hibernating. And people are very open. People are very friendly in winter because they're not so busy. They're bored. Come on in, sit down, let's talk. Where in summer, everyone is out, busy, preoccupied with all sorts of things. So really, the winter is the better time to walk. If it's hot in the summer, I really just want to sit in the shade and drink a cold beer and, you know, not go and walk 40 kilometers. So I like winter. Each his own. Okay, I accept it.
Yeah, but I forget about the part that people have more time to just interact because there's nothing else to do.
Right, right. Yeah. So it's a monotony breaker. Pilgrimage is a monotony breaker for the host communities, wherever, a family or a church or wherever I end up staying. But for me also, I always must go to a shrine or a pilgrim destination. That's the distinction between a pilgrim and a vagabond. A pilgrim has a specific destination that the pilgrim wants to get to. So there's always something like a magnetic pull drawing ever closer. And I go to places I've not been before. So each and every step is somewhere new. What's around the next bend? That's also something magnetic, you know. It also keeps me drawing closer. I haven't seen this next view, so I want to go and see it. Every person I meet is somebody new for me. So these add, like, elements of sort of intrigue and excitement and the unknown and curiosity. It's never boring, never.
How would you, obviously you're walking from one place and you're walking to a sacred site. How would you define a pilgrimage? What does a pilgrimage mean to you?
Well, as I say, a pilgrim must have a destination. So first and foremost, it is the destination. It's really, at the end of the day, it's not about the journey, as is so often said. It is about the destination. Because if you don't have that desire to get to the destination, then by human nature, by any, you know, anyone's kind of discipline or self-control, you can become very distracted and say, oh, this is a really nice mountain valley. It's beautiful here. I think I'll stay a month or a year. Many places where I go, people offer me this. Please stay with us a month. You know, in Arabic, in the Arabic language going across North Africa, the month and the moon, it's sort of the same concept. Stay with us for a cycle of the moon. We have so much to learn from you, and you have so much to learn from us. This is great. But I can't because I'm a pilgrim, and I want to always continue closer to my destination. Also, I generally have some visa restrictions. I have to stay in one country no more than usually 90 days, or it could vary. But, you know, having that destination is a very important part of the pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a wandering journey. I'm not a wanderer or a sojourner. I'm specifically a pilgrim going to a sacred destination. So for me, I'm a Roman Catholic, and so I choose the destination to be sacred in a Christian sense. But, you know, that's not the whole of pilgrimage. All of the major religions and so many cultures of the world have pilgrimage in their heritage, in their historical culture. So just for me, I'm not saying this is how to be a pilgrim, go to a Catholic shrine, but I happen to go to Catholic shrine.
Mm-hmm. I was really touched by that someone would say, you know, stay here until the next moon. I was reading in one of the newspaper articles, and I quote here, it said, she started relying on humanity every night on her third pilgrimage. As she walked from Kiev to Patras, Greece, she had to ask for a place to stay at night, and she always found a church or farmhouse, something. What changed in this third pilgrim where you started to rely on humanity?
Well, the first two, I don't consider the first mini pilgrimage from León to Santiago, that spur of the moment one. I don't consider that in my repertoire of my big pilgrimages. That was just my little taste at the beginning to get me into it. So my first one, Canterbury to Rome, and then followed the following year by Aachen, Germany, the tomb of Charlemagne, to Santiago. These are both areas really steeped in pilgrim heritage, going back to Charlemagne. That's why I started there. So it goes back to the 8th century that pilgrims have been in this Western European area, and those two destinations, two of the three big pilgrim destinations in the Middle Ages in the height of European Christian pilgrimage. So it's inculcated in the culture that pilgrimage exists and pilgrims are to be helped, and it's in the world. Plus, Western Europe, these areas are far more densely populated. So there are towns and villages, and these towns and villages, in part because of the long heritage of pilgrimage, they have hostels, they have places where pilgrims know to go and stay. Plus, for more pampered pilgrims or posher pilgrims, they have hotels, pensions, you know, everything yeah. on the economic strata. But my third pilgrimage, because at that time I could not, as an American citizen with a U.S. passport, I could not walk from Europe to Jerusalem, the third of the major pilgrim destinations. I could not walk by land either through Syria or through Libya. So I needed to pick a new, cool, intriguing pilgrim destination, and I chose the route of the Apostle St. Andrew, the brother of St. Peter, whose tomb is in Rome. So I started at Kiev, Ukraine, because that was as far north as they say he went. And I walked everywhere he went, everywhere I could research and find that he went, I went, to his tomb in Patra, Greece. But this part of Eastern Europe, this behind the former Iron Curtain, if you will, this part of Europe never had or hasn't had in memory any kind of pilgrim culture. And the villages are spread further apart, very small. They have no hostels for pilgrims. They have nothing in their infrastructure to accommodate pilgrims. Also, by that time, I was by and large out of money. So I couldn't, you know, just fund my way going specifically to the bigger towns or cities that had public accommodations like this. So I just really, that's when I became a pilgrim of faith. I really just, with faith, stepped out of Kiev in the snow late November, and I walked through the first village and talked with the people there in really halting Russian or Ukrainian, I kind of mixed them up, the words that I had learned, and said, I'm a pilgrim going to the tomb of St. Andrew. I need a place to sleep tonight. And boy, I was uncertain at all, just absolute no idea what the reaction, what the reception would be, and it was glorious. They were so accommodating, so wonderful, and I just, that first week, every day, got more and more confident that, yes, this will work. Yes, people are good. Hmm. People are very happy to help. Even though it's quite an impoverished area, this part of eastern Ukraine that's now been occupied or whatever the political situation is with Russian, but I could not do this pilgrimage today because of this situation. But at the time, you know, this is an impoverished agricultural area. They have very little, but what they had, share some of the floor space and the blankets because the family sleeps on the floor on little mats. There, one more person only adds worth through the party. So I could just lie down next to them and sleep just where they did, share the borscht, the vegetable soup that's always on the stove, without being a burden on them, yet their reception, their just that opportunity to help a stranger, really, it was equally felt by me to be helped and by them to have the opportunity to help somebody. It was beautiful. It was the most beautiful experience of human interaction in the unknown. I mean, now I have years of experience doing that, but those first days and weeks out of Kiev, there was like kind of a thrill accompanied by something of anxiety, but when I got more accustomed to it, it was so beautiful.
Yeah, wow. It sounds pretty incredible. And that happened along the whole route.
Yes, because it was similar, Crimea, then I went into Moldova a little bit, Romania, Bulgaria, the north of Turkey, and then all through the mainland of Greece. And it was same thing. Everywhere I went, people not having the experience of pilgrims, saying things like, we haven't heard of a pilgrim since the time of our grandfather's grandfather. And in the time of our grandfather's grandfather, no outsider has visited our village. So thank you for coming. You know,
oh,
they're
wow.
just so so welcoming, but because no, who else would go there?
Wow. That's
just
beautiful.
A pilgrim.
I'm sure along the way you went through, you know, rural areas as well as urban areas. Did you find any difference in traveling through the two?
Well, mostly I stay in rural areas. You know, I don't like to walk alongside of a road for my own safety. I mean, not only the vehicular traffic safety issues, but just to be a target, to be clearly not from around there, because I'm walking not dressed the way they dress and with a small backpack and clearly alone.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want to be so visibly seen by cars going or trucks going very fast, you know, that kind of transient mentality. But on the rural areas, on the country roads, then the only people who are going to be on that road are the people who live there, the local population. So I feel much safer there. And then it's more of a curiosity thing. So for my own safety, and if I listen to those cars going by so fast, that's not the natural pace of life. But if I'm on a rural country road and I'm walking and maybe there's a horse and a cart, these sounds are the natural pace of life. This is very harmonious, very stress-free. It's really a wonderful thing. This is, in my opinion, why a pilgrimage really is so much better to do on foot. Forget the bicycle pilgrims. I mean, to go to Santiago, these are okay, but to walk at the natural pace, what the human body was meant to do, these 3 miles an hour, 5 kilometers an hour, this allows you to see all sorts of things, to taste the herbs that you step on and you taste them in the air immediately, or smell the very different scents, not just the farmland. You smell the individual flowers, and to listen to not the cacophony of animal sounds, but different birds individually. So all of these kind of sensual elements of pilgrimage come by walking. No other way, not on a bicycle, not on a horse. This is from walking. So if I'm going to walk, I want to walk either on a footpath or in the open countryside, just cross country, or on a small, quiet, rural road. So I do tend to avoid the bigger cities, and this is all over wherever I go, except if in a bigger city there is some particular shrine or beautiful cathedral or something of historical, unique historical interest, then I'll go there, but you know, I don't linger. I just touch and go. Yeah. I continue on every day. Every day I walk.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I feel like one of the really unique things about your past 9 years is that you generally do a pilgrimage in the winter, and then you're kind of back to quote-unquote regular life. And so I feel like our world is so fast-paced right now. And to move from that to, you know, as you would say, 3 miles an hour pace, how do you fit back in, and what do you feel like you're lacking in regular life, if anything?
Well, the re-entry, those weeks and months after the pilgrimage, is always a very difficult transitional time. It's much easier to dive into a pilgrimage than to kind of come out of it. So the first, let me think, 4 pilgrimages, or really the 3 pilgrimages, to Santiago, to Rome, or to Rome, to Santiago, then to Patra, Greece, those 3, each time I thought, that's it, just finish this pilgrimage, have the adventure, and go back to real life, go back to working. I was working in Europe for a long time. So, you know, go back to that normal life. But I couldn't. For whatever reason, I was really drawn not to go back to that life, not quite yet. And after the 4th pilgrimage, Denver to Mexico City, I had to sort of like run away from the world to have a good think. And I went as far away as the Shetland Islands, way north of Scotland, with Wi-Fi available to me and a computer available. And I sat for 2 months there kind of figuring out what is the right path of my life, because I really enjoyed the pilgrim life. And that, for after Mexico, that transition back into normalcy really kind of hit me hard. The materialism, the commercialism, the noise constantly, And the being in one place, you know, not having that new view around the next corner. That was just too much. And after even just, I think, 2 months back in Denver, which is my base at that time, I went off to the Shetland Islands for 2 months to think about this. Am I a pilgrim or am I an engineer, or is there some way I can make both happen?
Hmm.
And that's when kind of, for my convenience, though, tragically, the Arab Spring broke out. I mean, it was very bad, all wars are, but it allowed me the opportunity, maybe I could get to Jerusalem by land, by foot. And so I took that chance, and I succeeded. It was not easy walking through North Africa during their civil wars, but it wasn't without obstacles or difficulties, but I made it. And when I arrived in Jerusalem, I just knew I am a pilgrim for the rest of my life. And I also understood this to be, I am a pilgrim, a mendicant pilgrim, a kind of pilgrim without carrying any material things of value. It's really my small backpack with a blanket, some clothes, some toiletries, really sandals, really bare minimum though. And no money, no jewelry, no cell phone, no computer, no camera, nothing anyone would want to steal from me. This is my principle of, this is how it evolved into this. And then, so in one part when I was in Jerusalem, I realized I am to be a pilgrim, but also to help other pilgrims. Whatever their pilgrim style might be, through even just encouraging them or helping them plan a pilgrim route or leading them on a pilgrimage. Part of my life is to help other pilgrims and to speak about it, to share about the pilgrim life, you know, to sort of armchair pilgrim audiences or something like this. So I kind of got into a rhythm where I have my pilgrim season, and, you know, whether it's a pilgrimage of 3 or 4 or 5 months, 7, 8 months, or just divided in the year or all at one go. But more than half the year I am a pilgrim in my solo way. But then the off season is when I'm helping other pilgrims and preparing myself for my next pilgrimage. So when I'm not on pilgrimage, based here in Denver, I do have the opportunity to continue the pilgrim life, even though I'm not moving and walking every day. I realized on my sixth pilgrimage, the Buenos Aires to Mexico City, 11 months, 13,000 kilometers, is too much for me. Everything, my clothing was falling apart, my boots were falling apart, my backpack was falling apart. I had, you know, every night virtually I was there sewing some repair.
Uh-huh.
So, and I became very meager. It really took a lot out of my body that I just couldn't, you know, if I'm burning in the high Andes 5,000 calories a day, I'm a tiny woman. I can't eat that. I just can't.
Yes.
Even if it were available, it's too much. So I would lose a lot of weight. So I always fatten up before the pilgrimage and then lose my weight during the pilgrimage. And so, you know, I can't just be on pilgrimage around the calendar. So I do have to have a pilgrim season and an off season. And during the off season, I still have, I miss the rhythm of walking all the time, every day, and getting up and moving every day. But I do have the opportunity to help other pilgrims with planning or leading them or, you know, just encouraging them. And this is an important part to kind of continue the pilgrim experience even when I'm not actually on pilgrimage. This has definitely helped my transition, my re-entry after the pilgrimage.
That's great. One of the things that, you know, I find really pretty phenomenal is that you walk without any money. and as you were sharing, you know, of course, if you're out there for almost a year, it's not just food and shelter, but your clothes start to fall apart, you know. How did you decide that? And two, how do you take care of, you know, any sort of basic needs like toiletries, toothpaste, you know, or any medical emergencies? Can you share a little bit about what your experience has been walking without money in that sense?
Yes, and I'll answer your two parts in reverse order. How do I get things like the silly little toiletries or whatever? People ask me all the time, perhaps not every day, but nearly every day, pilgrim, how can I help you? What do you need? Is there anything I can do? And honestly, if I need toothpaste, I say, oh, I need toothpaste. And they will invariably reach into their medicine cabinet and hand me a half a tube of toothpaste and say, please take it. And I'm happy to take it. So, you know, generally these little toiletries, these small things, people just, they just come, whatever little things I need. I wear contact lenses. I need contact solutions. So often I can go into any town of size, small city. If I go to an optometrist anywhere in the world and say, I use this kind of contact lens solution, they give me the bottles of the trial size all the time. It's not an issue whatsoever. They're happy to help me out. So, and I don't feel that that's a burden for them. It's just, I ask, and hey, I receive, just like it says in the Bible. So these sorts of consumable supplies, I suppose, and the same does go with food. People always want to send me off on the day with enough food to feed the tribe for a week, and I'm like, no, just what I can eat today. That's all I want. It, you know, my backpack becomes something of a pantry at times.
Yes.
But, you know, I just try to only accept what I need. And, you know, this old adage, beggars can't be choosers, is wrong. Beggars must be choosers, because when you have things that you don't need, they become a burden. And why would I want to be burdened by such things? So if somebody would say to me, okay, Pilgrim, you have to have some food for the day, but I don't really have anything. So here is the equivalent of $5 in whatever the currency is. So, okay, sometimes I decline. No, please, no. But sometimes I can't. It's just, they just make it impossible for me to say no. But now I'm burdened with that $5. But most importantly, and this is the first part of your question, money is really a danger. Not only is it a burden having to decide, well, how am I going to spend my $5? Should I get something with more protein or something with more calories or something, you know, that I can eat frozen? I'm usually outside in the winter. So, you know, it's a burden. How I have to make a decision now. If someone handed me a ham sandwich, I would accept the ham sandwich without a second thought. But now I have to think about, do I want ham or do I want tuna fish? You know, it's a decision. So, but the other thing is, even if all I have is that equivalent of $5, if I go to a coffee shop and someone sees me with this money, or, you know, two kids see me with this money, I'm really a small woman. I can't protect that. They'll think if I have that $5, clearly I'm a traveler, then I must have more. I try to announce everywhere I go, oh, I'm a pilgrim, I have no money. But that doesn't work if I'm standing there holding the
$5.
So, right. And so they'll think, you know, some disreputable people out there might have bad thoughts and try to rob me because I'm easy pickings. Because I'm just small, and, you know, I'm wearing clunky big hiking boots. I can't run. Mm-hmm. I can't really seed this. I can't protect myself in this way. So it's better to have nothing. And if someone says, how can I help you? I don't have any food really for you to take, but take this $5. I would be more inclined to say, thank you, no, I'll be fine. And then if I go out somewhere, and if it turns out that I am hungry, and I usually am never hungry during the day, I'm busy walking, but I might get thirsty. And in the winter, I might want to just go into a little village shop and get warm. I'll sit there and sparking the conversation. They'll say, hey, stranger. I'll say, yes, I'm a pilgrim. I'm going to whatever shrine. They'll pour me a cup of coffee or tea. They'll offer me a biscuit or a sandwich. You know, even I don't ask. I don't really want it all the time, but I have to accept their generosity because I don't want to hurt their feelings. I want them to allow them to help me on my pilgrimage, to participate in my pilgrimage in that way. So this is why the money thing, it's sort of foolish. And I learned on my third pilgrimage when I went from Kiev to Tatra, I went through six different countries with six different currencies. So, like, I'd be having to change money all the time.
Constantly, yes.
And again, that's another burden and another safety issue for me. So, and, you know, you can't change the coins and all of this, you know. So it's just, no, it's better without. And I transitioned into this. I didn't think it all out ahead of time and say, now I will act. It just sort of evolved and saying, yes, now I have no money on me and I'm happy and I'm relieved and I have no stress. Mm. So it's better this way. And then the same with the jewelry. And, you know, I used to wear a ring my grandmother had given to me. And someone once said, you know, well, yeah, you can stay here, but you ought to pay me something. And mom said, well, I have nothing. And she said, you have a ring. I said, a gold ring. I mean, not worth a lot. But yeah. I was like, no, it's from my grandmother. So I kept my ring, but at the end of that pilgrimage, I gave it to one of my nieces. So, you know, it still maintains that sentimental value. But I understood. I bring something into a community, whether it's money or jewelry, and somebody is even tempted to steal, the sin is mine. I should not have these things if I don't need them. Mm-hmm. I remember my grandmother, whether I'm wearing her ring or not. So there's no sense to it. Mm-hmm. So that's how it became that way.
Yeah, and that's so beautiful. I feel like it's so empowering to think of money in that way. I also wonder, to have that sort of mindset where you're okay with whatever is given to you. I feel like there needs to be a certain sense of detachment, you know, where when you want a cup of coffee, you might not get it. You may get what you need, but you don't get what you want. Like, what are your thoughts on that? Have you struggled with that as you walk?
Well, I definitely prefer a properly made cup of coffee than Nescafe, but if somebody offers me Nescafe, I will accept it. And I'll remember, well, this is what this person has to offer, and I'm really happy. Anyway, I'm really delighted this person's willing to share. So it's a kind of a shameful thing for me to even think about standards, like having a higher standard in coffee or tea or something like this. And I'm just so happy that I can be there, present in the moment with these people from such diverse cultures. I don't give it a second thought. I might give it a first thought. Oh, I was hoping for a good cup of coffee, and I got Nescafe again. but it's just, you know, what I'm accustomed to. I had worked in Europe for so long. I had worked all around the U.S. I never had such an attachment to, like a family home or homesickness or any of those things. I had already a 20-year career that sort of buffered me and separated me from those sorts of things. So, you know, I don't know that I'm the most common attitude toward this, if I have that, but I don't worry about, I'm not brand loyal. You can give me Crest toothpaste or Colgate toothpaste, I'm happy.
Well, I mean, not just, you know, brand loyalty or deep preferences, but what if you don't get any food? Have you had times where you're walking so much throughout the day, so you're starving by the end of it, I'm sure. happens if nothing is offered?
Firstly, it rarely happens. It rarely happens that nothing is offered. It occasionally does, but I'm not sure about physiology and metabolism and all of these dynamics, but I can say if I'm walking all day long, I'll try to have a good size but not a heavy breakfast in the morning. Mm-hmm. And then just some pocket food during the day, which would be whatever, some nuts or dried fruit or a piece of fruit or something small that I really literally keep in the pocket of my jacket. Mm-hmm. And just little food during the day. And then in the evening, have a meal. But I'm never starving. It's not like a blood sugar fluctuation. I have such a steady rhythm, steady output of energy, that not bursts of energy. I think that's one of the factors. So there are times when I'm just like, yeah, if you put food in front of me, I'll be happy to eat it. But if you don't, I'm kind of too tired to eat anyway. It'll be fine. I'll eat tomorrow.
I'll survive.
if I skip a meal, really, it's going to be fine. And, you know, maybe I'll eat my last bit of granola that I'm carrying with me because someone 2 days prior had given it to me. Mm-hmm. Or I generally carry a few tea bags with me or some ground coffee or sometimes, you know, it just depends where I am. If I have some sort of kind of reserve food, and that'll be enough, a little snack, it'll be fine.
Great mental freedom.
Yeah, and I just don't worry about it. I think young men are different. Young men must eat. Older women, we just want to be sure we have a safe place to sleep, and everything else will just work out. So I don't worry. But really, people do want to help people. And when the easiest thing people can do to help another person is to offer food. Mm. And so, I mean, like I said earlier, it's more often the case that I'm trying to push people away. No, I can't take that kilo of kielbasa you just smoked in the bar. It's too much.
Yeah.
And they'll still give it to me, you know. Mm. So it's usually I'm pushing food away. It's rare. And it's rare that someone would not offer me something to eat.
Hmm. That's beautiful. Simple.
It's never been a problem.
Offering food, yes. And you said that your journey started as a touristic pilgrim and then slowly evolved to a spiritual pilgrim and ultimately progressed to a servant pilgrim. Yes. Can you share a little bit about what that means to you, especially the spiritual pilgrim, or touristic, you know, I can understand, then spiritual pilgrim and then progressing to servant pilgrim?
I can say the first two pilgrimages, the one to Rome and the one to Santiago, Finisterre, in Western Europe, everyone there is some level of a touristic pilgrim because all of the communities along the way, there are guidebooks. I didn't use a guidebook, but there are guidebooks that kind of demarcate the trail and the accommodations available and all of these sort of touristic things. I mean, just functionally, it's touristic.
Yes.
The yellow arrows,
I remember.
And in Italy, they're giant white arrows. So, you know, you can't help but kind of fall into those the pathways of expectations. And I never carried a camera, but people are all over with cameras and everything. These are touristic elements. Mm-hmm. But the third pilgrimage, as I mentioned earlier too, that it really became more of a spiritual thing. It was forget these touristic things, forget the expectations both on my side and the host community sides. They don't know what a pilgrim is the way any family in Spain will know what a pilgrim is and what a pilgrim needs and how to accommodate them or how to direct them. But in Ukraine, it was not that way. And so it really was far more interhuman experience, very much more a spiritual element. And I was staying more in Orthodox, first Russian Orthodox, and then Romanian Orthodox, Bulgarian Orthodox, these different kinds of monasteries if they were around. And so it was more philosophical and thought-provoking for me. Mm-hmm. And so these together might be, the seeking part of inherent in any pilgrimage. But once I had gotten to Jerusalem after the end of the fifth pilgrimage, went to South America, then across the U.S., then back to Eastern Europe, but from Helsinki down to through the Balkans and ending in Rome, these areas also no common pilgrim tradition in modern times, that it really was, I was understanding that it's almost more important for the pilgrim to arrive in whatever the community is at the end of the day, it's more important for those people to see the pilgrim than it is for the pilgrim to see the people. You know, pilgrim needs a place to sleep, yes. But the inner human, the interaction between people, between cultures, it was just very remarkable. How many places in South America, high in the Andes or in the Atacama Desert or the jungles, so many places I went, so far off the beaten track was I, that I was the first white person anyone had seen. This was in North Africa, too. I was in the tribal areas with the Berbers and the Bedouins, the various Bedouin tribes. They had never seen a white person. And, you know, to allow them to touch my skin and say, hey, it's okay, you can touch. Or they've never seen blue eyes, and they say, wow, you must have so much light in your soul. Yeah, it's beautiful. Oh. Or light, fluffy hair. They're just, you know, I can see they're tempted, even the boys, the little boys, they're tempted to touch. Go ahead, you can touch my hair too, because they've never seen anything like it. And how powerful that is for them, you know. And so it is something of this service to go out in the world with the intent, making the effort to meet the neighbors of the world. All of the religions have love your neighbor as yourself, but someone's got to make the effort to go out and meet the neighbor, to be the other. When they say, we've never seen a white person, we've never seen blue eyes, we've never seen light, fluffy hair. To some places, we've never seen an American. Oh, we thought you'd be bigger. And, you know, no, I'm very small. But others are bigger. I'm not as big as most of them. You know, to be the other that they might have heard about or had ideas about, but now here they are sitting in, you know, their own hut. So that's a very empowering thing, but it is a service to say, yep, I'm just a person just like you, and I do need a safe place to sleep tonight, and I need some protection, I need some water, and I need something to eat, just like you. And so it really kind of reduces the bubble that we all want to have around ourselves, you know? We're just people. We're just people.
Beautiful.
It's a service, then.
Well, after having walked through 44 countries, meeting so many different people, cultures, religions, do you feel that there's something universally true across all people, no matter where they live?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. With small children who just reach out and they just, people are just people. And just within the culture, people, like I say, everywhere, they want to offer food. They want to make sure I'm protected. This is a big thing, too, distinguishing what I do as a servant pilgrim going out. I do it alone. I mean, when I'm helping other pilgrims, that's a different thing. I'm sort of empowering them and helping them become future pilgrims on their own. But it's really important to be solo. Now, of course, being a solo pilgrim, there's a greater sense of vulnerability. Well, there's greater vulnerability. It's not only a sense of it. It is. There's a greater vulnerability. But I think people universally see there's somebody vulnerable. And if I can dispel immediately any kind of threat, easy to do, a small woman, right. I can dispel a sense of threat, then it suddenly builds that trust. And trust is the foundation of peace. And this is really the bottom line of it. Peace is universal. So I don't go with this mindset of going out into the world to build peace, because you can quickly go into the arguments forever. Well, what is peace? Is it the absence of war? Is it the absence of violence? Is it an internal serenity? Is it an obedience to God? What is peace? We can discuss it forever. But trust is trust, and trust is between individual people. It's not between cultures. It's between people. Mm-hmm. So if I can build the trust, trust is the foundation of peace. Peace is universal. It cuts across every kind of culture or lifestyle or economic strata or educational strata. Peace is peace. So this is an important part of it. And I think if I'm alone, especially being so clearly vulnerable, in the winter if it's 40 below or in the jungle, if it's so, you know, the vegetation is growing as quickly as you look at it, people lean in toward me and they kind of scoop me up, making a gesture to scoop. Come with us. Come where it's safe. Mm-hmm. Come where we can sit by the fire and have some warmth. Mm-hmm. Come toward us. If I were there with another person, whether it's a man or a woman, and we're speaking in a common language to ourselves, but that's different than the community, that's immediate distrust. That's immediate suspicion. Mm-hmm. People would physically retract their shoulders back and point and say, what do you think they're saying? Where do you think they're from? What do you think they're doing? Instantly, it's distrust. That would have to be overcome. But I'm alone, and I'm vulnerable, and so it just really greases the skids of trust very quickly.
I was actually, you know, I was thinking about, it seems like most of the time, you know, things go well, but you've had your share of challenges. I remember reading an article that mentioned that you found yourself facing drug dealers in Mexico City, I think it was. And I was thinking also about, you know, that some of these places that you've traveled, just the trip from, you know, Buenos Aires to Mexico City, traveling through the Colombian jungles and through the Darien Gap in Panama, which no one, you know, it's not for the faint of heart. Can you share a little bit about how you've gone through that? Does fear ever come up? Do you ever feel like, what have I gotten myself into? and how
no,
do you,
I've never felt that.
Yeah?
But I can say this unequivocally. This is not bravado. Truly, I have never felt afraid for my life. I've never had that sort of frozen heart sensation for that moment of fear. I've never had that on pilgrimage. Never. The two greatest challenges, of course, are the wilderness, the terrain, the wildlife. These are inherent dangers, so control them. And then the other major danger out there in the world, men with guns. That's the bottom line, men with guns. So be they soldiers or outlaws, it sort of doesn't matter, men with guns or men with guns. The first story you alluded to, it was not in Mexico City. It was in the Chihuahua Desert, outside, just south of the U.S.-Mexican border. In the desert, vast desert, a vegetated desert, lots of cactus and rock formations, not the kind of desert that's you can see great distances. So, but I was far from the only one highway, the Pan-American Highway. I was far away from that, alluding to the safety, stay away from the site of the through-going traffic. So just in the desert, quickly, before I couldn't see it coming, but a giant King Cab pickup truck with giant tires made for the desert sands with four mounted weapons in the back of the pickup truck, four men stationed there. Four men, they came up so fast. Four men got out, all of the men, armed with automatic weapons, like, I don't know, high-powered rifles with sights right at me, surrounding me, but also with pistols and the bandoliers. I mean, they really looked the part. Eight
wow.
men surrounded me so quickly in the desert, couldn't run anywhere, couldn't hide anywhere. But to me, there was no fear. The absurdity of it really made me laugh. I mean, really, eight men with guns, really, for one woman? There's no one macho here.
What did you do? What was your response?
My response, without even thinking about it ahead of time, I didn't plan out that response because it happened too quickly. I relaxed my shoulders. I smiled. I pushed the closest gun that was right in front of me. I mean, they're all literally pointing their guns at my head. Uh-huh. I pushed the one away, and I looked at the guy, and I smiled and just said, "Really?" Because it really was over the top, absurd. The four men on the ground and the four men in the pickup, all pointing their guns at me. Really? Is that what you think it takes? Really? That was it. Really? And I smiled, and I was calm. And we had a conversation, and I was only learning Spanish then, and so it was in Spanish, but I was saying, you know, they were saying, "Who are you? Where are you going? Blah, blah, blah." "I'm a pilgrim. I'm going to the shrine Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City." And they said, "That's too far. You can't get there." And I said, "Well, I've already come from Denver. I'm almost at the halfway point." And they're like, "Yeah, who else are you with? Where are all these people?" I said, "No, I walk with the angels and the saints." And they're saying, "That can't be." Like, they were so incredulous about the whole thing that they themselves kind of relaxed. They put their weapons down, and we were all sort of relaxed. And they were trying to be aggressive, saying, "Why aren't you afraid? Are you crazy?" Like, literally, "Are you crazy?" I said, "No, I'm not crazy. I'm a pilgrim." And they said, and this was the key, they said, "Well, why aren't you afraid of us? We have weapons." And I said, "Look, I'm a pilgrim. My pilgrimage is either going to end at the Basilica of Guadalupe or it's going to end in heaven. Either way, it's okay." And these narcotraficantes, so rugged and aggressive, and no doubt with sordid pasts, the chief among them just said, "Really? Okay, hey, pilgrim, would you pray for us?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, I have a little booklet to write the prayer intentions." And I did, all the way from Denver. And there were already 100 of them, more prayer intentions written in Spanish in my little booklet. They passed that booklet around, and they all wrote their prayer intentions. And they were beautiful things, like, "Pray for my little son, Jose. I don't want him going into this life." This is what these narcotraficantes were saying, because they encountered a true pilgrim. And if that were a fabrication if I did not believe equally either my pilgrimage ends at Guadalupe or my pilgrimage ends in heaven, and either way I'm okay with it, then mm-hmm. it would have fallen apart. But mm-hmm. since then, I mean, with other men with guns I've encountered, certainly I have learned the savvy of it all. It's easy. If I try, that's aggression. If I try to respond to aggression with aggression, oh, come on, I'll lose. I'm 5 feet tall. I'll lose. Mm-hmm. No way. If I try to respond to aggression with defiance, well, that'll just irritate whoever the man with the gun is, and that's it. I'm dead. This is not going to work. Defiance mm-hmm. won't work. If I respond to the aggression with fear, oh, that's going to be worse. If they know that they have this sense of fear over me, they're holding me in fear, that's just going to feed their egos and feed their whatever. It's going to be bad for me. The only real way to respond to aggression with success is to be relaxed and calm and smile and gentle and try to talk to them. And I do realize if I can initiate the conversation, you know, before they can speak, if I can hold that conversation, start it, direct it, it's much better. And many times I've encountered other men with guns in difficult, dangerous situations. And again, I start the conversation. And generally, it's with a smile saying, hi, how you doing? Hey, do you have any water? If I'm in a desert, I'm going to ask for water. And if I kind of give them a task, you know, please get me some water, be my host, get me some water, they'll do it. And then they'll feel like they're really? Contributing to their pilgrimage. Yeah. So, beautiful. You know, controlling the conversation, maintaining calm, but mm-hmm. I can do that only because it is a true belief that either the pilgrimage ends at the shrine, whatever, or the pilgrimage ends in heaven, and, you know, it's a good place to end a pilgrimage, too.
It is. You have to be really not be afraid of death.
Right.
Do you feel like when you have thoughts where it seems like you've been, you know, kind of facing it so many times. I can't imagine the stories you have from your pilgrimage. Have you ever felt like, okay, this is, you know, if I was to go right now, this is not the time?
Yeah. Well, the only thing along those lines is if some places where I've been and facing dangers that, well, today's as good a day to die as any other day, but I'm so far away from, no one knows I'm here, I'm so remote, like, you know, no one will know the story. No one will know how I met my end. They just will know I didn't make it to the end. You know, I try to communicate through my blog or through emails every couple of weeks, but, you know, no one, there have been places where I've realized if I were to fall off that cliff or if I were to get shot by those bad guys in the jungle, no one would find the body, no one would know. Mm-hmm. Sad. But I can't control that. You know, that's just part and parcel to the adventure pilgrim's life. It's not going to make me go always only in safe areas with a little note or breadcrumbs, you know, here's how I met the end. But I have a strong faith, and I have a great devotion to the Catholic saints. So to me, it's sort of like there's a party on the other side, and they've all been watching me, and we'll have a great entry. That's a bit of an unknown for me, but, you know, it's not one that I'm afraid of going toward. Mm.
Thank you so much, Anne and Gary, for sharing the story. Sorry, I really hesitated to interrupt. And it's 10 o'clock, and I want to remind the listeners on the line, if you have any questions or reflections, please hit *6 on your phone, and or you can email us. ask@theservice.org, and we can continue the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Xiao. Of course, I have tons of questions still, but I will, you know, anytime anybody needs to jump in, Xiao, please feel free to let me know. Since you had spoken about faith, I know you're a Catholic, but where does really your faith come from? Do you have a practice? Do you have what is it that keeps you so grounded through all these times? Every day is an unknown.
Unknown.
It's totally unknown, and it's so obvious when you're on a pilgrimage. You know, we kind of, during, when you're not you're fooled by life. You think every day is the same, but it's not. And I wonder, where does your faith really come from?
I've come to realize, without being instructed this way, but I've come to realize that I think strength, faith is something like a muscle. The more I walk, the more I use the muscles of my legs, the stronger they become. And I'm out there every day in the unknown, every day with some dangers, with uncertainty. But the faith part of it, like a muscle, gets stronger every day. If you use it every day, truly use it every day. Faith should not be something reserved for an hour on Sunday morning. And when you use it every day, it's just always there. That the strength of it is without question. There's no point of thought, oh, I've got to pull on my faith now. I really need it now. No, yeah. It's there all the time, and it's as strong as I need it to be, and I'm confident about it. So it's built up over the pilgrimage. Before my pilgrim life, I was a Catholic, but, you know, if Mass were convenient, because I was living in Europe and traveling all around all the time for my job, I didn't have a strong parish. I wasn't centered in my parish. I was always making sure I got to Mass on Sunday generally, but it was a different kind of practice. Now I'm definitely strengthened in my Catholic faith, questioning it, but able to go into Orthodox monasteries or Catholic ones or even the Muslims ones, centers when I was in North Africa, and sit and have an intellectual discussion about theology, like applied theology, because that's what I do, though I have no background in the theory of theology. I've got a lot of practical application. So the faith comes from using it and recognizing it as an element. I can't go without it. The knowledge of the Catholic saints, knowing that these were people too who lived some time before and their faith got them through. So sort of, I get it. Using them as an example, it strengthens my faith. Using my faith every day, knocking on a door and not knowing what it's going to be like on the other side of that door, but just having the confidence and the serenity, the calmness, I'll deal with whatever happens. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
It'll be adventurous. So I'm okay.
That's beautiful. so one area that I really wanted to know about out of my own curiosity is how you traveled through the Darien Gap in Panama. You know, as I said, that's not for the faint of heart. I was reading that there was an international jogger that ran through that area, and he had 6 bodyguards running with him. And then I was trying to imagine you going through that. What was your experience like?
I would not have 6 bodyguards. That would just slow me down. And I would not recommend it. I don't want to say I did it, everyone, come on in, the water's fine. It was difficult. It could not be done from Panama into Colombia. But going from Colombia into Panama, it's because I kept asking along the way. I was like, I'm a pilgrim. I'm going to Mexico City. I want to keep heading north. And I was asking priests, police, the military point in Colombia, the officials. And they just kept directing me across some river. Here, get in this mango boat, the canoe. They'll take you across the river. Then you can continue on your way. And so I was being kind of directed and funneled upward until the last village of Colombia, rough area, and military checkpoint. And he's just like, good luck to you, pilgrim. And that was it. I was like, shouldn't you stamp my passport that I'm leaving Colombia? No, no, no. Just waving me through. No, no. And I got hooked up with some, as it turns out, human traffickers. I didn't really know that. But they were taking others through. And so they did not encourage me to go alone. In fact, with the guns, they told me I could not. And I realized afterwards, too, that it's because it's really not all that difficult to head north. Just go north. Mm-hmm. You'll eventually hit Panama. But the Darien Gap, I should say, is something like 160 kilometers of no roads or no pathways or no official law or anything between Colombia and Panama. Mm. So going through there were tribal people, the I think Puna tribes on their houses there, and they're visited periodically by missionaries, Catholic missionaries. And then there are these communities of, down there it's termed the Afro-Colombianos, so these sort of, they've been runaway slaves from 300 years ago, and they've just sort of made these enclaves living in the jungle where no one will sort of bother them. And the primary surface industry is mangoes. They collect the mangoes and the mahogany wood. But then there's a lot of, there is drug trafficking, human trafficking. There's some paramilitary. There's all sorts of nefarious things happening there. But
yeah.
Because I'm a pilgrim.
Add to
and,
that wildlife, right? To add
oh, yeah.
To, like, where were you staying?
With the, in the tribal communities, the Afro-Colombiana communities. So they're little assembles of huts on stilts. And there are, the monk, in addition to the general snakes and poisonous frogs and piranhas in the water, because a lot of time it's just walking through water, the inundated streams. But there's also, there are some tigers. They roar. You hear them roar. I never saw one. Tigra, I think they're panthers is in English. But the monkeys were the most destructive, and they're just irritating. But it was the men with guns that was the problem. But I did make it through and eventually left the little group that, you know, you guys are just crazy. What are you going to do? You shoot an American. Sometimes I do get a little defiant. So I did say to this guy after the second day with them, go ahead, shoot an American in the back and see how your life changes. And I walked away.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't shoot me.
Wow.
And but I was very close to the Panamanian side. But I did get down to the Panamanian side, so I was deep in the jungle for many hours on my own without really knowing where I was going except heading north. And there's really no pathway because it grows over so quickly, you know, so it's just sort of an idea. Now, is it a pathway of the human traffickers or is it a pathway from animals? It was hard to know, but just heading north. Then I did find a big river, crossed that river, and encountered a Panamanian military encampment. And then I was prompt. I said, I'm a U.S. citizen. I'd like a stamp in my passport.
Yeah.
The first thing I did, and they took my passport and
wow.
Kind of imprisoned me for several days. And there, you know, I had a lot of adventures. And I did blog about this, so this is on my website or my blog site. But it's nothing anyone should do. I was detained for a total of 20 days. It did cost some money to get out, to be released finally from the final detention facility. The U.S. Embassy had to get involved. But, you know, I was able in the detention to fatten up a bit. I had gotten very thin, and so fattened up a bit and made friends with some of the other inmates.
Wow.
So, it is nothing I recommend. Don't do it. Take a boat and go around. Really,
yeah.
It is not worth the bragging rights of having gone through the Darien Gap.
I mean, I have like 100 questions to ask about that, but I think we've got several questions in the queue. So for
okay.
Now, I'm going to hand it over to Xiao. Xiao, if you at any time run out of questions, please feel free to hand Anne back over to me.
Yes, Julie, thank you. And let's go to the next listener online. Hello?
Hi there, it's Nicole.
Oh.
I'm in the other room with Anne. So I'm just so excited that other people get to hear the stories that I get to hear when Anne and I are hanging out when she's in Denver, and one of the stories or one of the perspectives that I really enjoy talking about with Anne is talking about when people say to you, Anne. Often I've heard you say, especially in Latin America too, that my life is a pilgrimage. And I would love to hear your response to that. Like, what being a pilgrim, when people say my life is a pilgrimage, how do you respond to that? What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, so that is quite a common question I get. It's not so much even a question. It's just a comeback, a response when they hear about what I do. And then I can see the wow factor on their faces. But then they go, oh, No, my life is a pilgrimage. Life is a pilgrimage in general, and we're all on a journey together. And I kind of at first would think, well, that's very nice, kind of fluffy, feel-good words to say. But I hear it a lot, so okay, I gave it more thought. What does that really mean? And I'm good, it's clear. Okay, if life is a pilgrimage, you have to know you're a pilgrim. And if you know you're a pilgrim, you have to know you're going to a destination, and you have to want to get there. So if you have all those boxes checked instead of the kind of self-gratuitous, yeah, life is a pilgrimage and I'm a pilgrim. Know you're a pilgrim, know where your destination is, want to get there, and know what it takes to get in there. So if you are a Christian pilgrim or a Christian and you say you're on a pilgrimage of life and your destination is heaven, okay, figure out what it takes to get to heaven. And it's pretty clear in the book. A rich person doesn't get to heaven. So if you're a pilgrim and you're on pilgrimage and you want to get to your pilgrim destination and you interpret that to be heaven, you better live your life so that you can get there, or you're really not, you're making a farce of it all. You know, if you're a pilgrim and you're going to Santiago, it's because you want to get to Santiago. Do you know what it takes to get there? Well, you know, if you have your credentiali, you get a certificate at the end. Okay, there's the requirement. You know, so, all right. Life is a journey. Life is a pilgrimage. But then accept that you are a pilgrim. Accept that, define what that means for you, and then know what it takes, know where your destination is, how to get there, and what it takes to get in. Then we're having a conversation, you know, but none of the kind of self-gratuitous, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It kind of just, it's not with thought, you know. You have to think about it.
Thank you. And if there's time at the end, I would love to hear the story of, like, the stone soup kind of story that's connected to that we were talking about yesterday. But I'm going to leave that because I know other people have time or have questions. So thanks, Anne.
Thank you, Nicole. And let's go to the next caller.
Hi, Anne. My name is Audrey, and I'm calling in from California. And thank you so much. It's been such a gift to hear all your stories. I kind of have two questions, or maybe a two-part question, but mm-hmm. So feel free to answer one or both or whatever I think there's time for. But one question was, when you're on a pilgrimage, I feel like you have so many hours to just be with yourself. And amidst all the incredible stories you shared, there's so many, I feel like there might be, you know, so many mundane moments or so many just long, drawn-out moments. And so I'm curious, you know, how do you process those moments? Or have you ever kind of had the question of, you know, why am I doing this? Or what am I doing? Or how do you process kind of those mundane moments? And go ahead.
Okay, so the first question, I rarely have a mundane moment. I can't even really think of too many. I've had so many experiences in life. I mean, we all have. I'm 52 now. I've had 52 years of experiences that I can reflect on, draw on, recontemplate. Just life experiences are always with me, always. I'm as an engineer, I think, and a creative engineer, I'm a non-linear thinker, non-sequential thinker. My brain can hold many thoughts in parallel and does all the time. My head is full of thousands of thoughts all the time, and I let them all think. One part of my brain always must be concerned about navigation and topography, right? Where am I going? Am I going in the right direction? One part of my brain is always focused on personal safety. Where are the men with guns? Where are the wild animals? Where is the edge of the cliff? So navigation, always safety, always security, always. But then in the mornings, my ritual is in the morning to read the Psalms of the day, two or three Psalms. So there's always something in there that I can sort of extract and look at with fresh eyes every morning, just some little snippet of an expression that seems pertinent at that moment, that day. So I'm always sort of contemplating the Psalms on a spiritual level. And then always also parallel in my head are the thoughts of the people I had maybe just left that morning or maybe had met the previous week or something. and there's something about their story or their lives that really touched me and really require greater and more continued thought. So at any given time, I'm thinking of lots of different things. And so what someone may consider mundane, I see as a great opportunity to allow my mind to think about things that are not exactly pertinent to that moment. If I am crossing the sand dunes of a desert, that the view does not change for the entire day or even days. So I don't have that sort of visual distraction or input, but it allows my brain the freedom to go deeper into kind of existing thoughts. So I don't have mundane thoughts. I never get bored. I'm comfortable with my own thoughts, comfortable with my own experience. So I don't get bored. I don't need external distractions to keep my focus.
Thank you. I have a second question, but I'll let you, if there's other callers in the queue, I'll let you go ahead.
Okay, you can, Audrey, thank you. And you can call back in again. Okay, let's go to the caller.
Hi, Anne, this is Nipun. I'm calling from California also. Thank you for a really inspiring call. So many of your stories touch on so many wonderful themes. The question I had, I think early on you mentioned, it's actually a two-part question, but early on you mentioned armchair pilgrims and different kinds of pilgrims, touristic pilgrims and then spiritual pilgrims. Do you think it's a progression, or do you think they all kind of have their values at different points in your own personal journeys? And what advice would you have for people who want to, feel a calling to leave their current state of life and become a pilgrim? And coupled with that, I suppose one thing you have you've mentioned that you consider it to be part of your calling to share this message with other people, and perhaps you do that in your off 6 months. But the question that I had was, how do you survive in those other 6 months when you're not on a pilgrimage? Do you have a job? Uh-huh. Do you do other things, or is it just kind of the same lifestyle but in a stationary context? So those are a couple of questions boxed into one.
Okay. I would say, firstly, I found such great comfort and resonance with the kind of pilgrim life I've sort of created or evolved into. It's suitable for me. I don't feel, though, that I'm like an expert in pilgrim life and can sort of dictate how people ought to be pilgrims or rank different kinds of pilgrimage. It's what, each for his own. But people should do what they're inspired to do. If they are called to be a pilgrim, they should kind of dial in again and find out what kind of pilgrim they're being called to be. There's nothing wrong with bus pilgrims or posh pilgrims, the kind on Santiago who put their backpacks in the taxi and meet up with them at the end of the day. It's not the way I would do it, but I wouldn't say that's wrong. It's just not for me. So I think there's lots of room, the huge spectrum, very, very broad spectrum for the different kinds of pilgrims. People should go through their life with thought and intent rather than just drifting, but it could be that it takes a pilgrimage to figure that out. So, let everyone evolve at their own kind of pace. I'm very comfortable being a servant pilgrim, but for me, it was a progression from something of a touristic pilgrim to a spiritual pilgrim, a pilgrim of faith, and now it's definitely I'm a Catholic pilgrim. I don't think every pilgrim needs to be Catholic, but if I'm Catholic, I'm going to be Catholic. I'm not going to just sort of reserve it for something an hour on Sunday morning. I'm fully a Catholic pilgrim. So it's what works for me. People should do it however they want. Any advice I would give is to say something that everyone has heard forever. Don't be afraid. Commit. The worst that can happen, you can just readjust your schedule or readjust your path if things just aren't working out. So just go for it, I would say. Don't be afraid. Take a chance and dive right in and be prudent, but don't be bound to somebody else's way of doing things. I kind of get irritated when I'm taking people on pilgrimage and then they say things like, what am I supposed to do? And what am I supposed to do? It's like, you're supposed to do what only you want to do. If you're supposing to do something, it's you're trying to get on somebody else's path. Well, there's no more room on my path. Get on your own path. So, you know, everyone should have their own way of doing it and not be afraid to go out and find their own expression of it. And I encourage people to do it, especially people I run into or people come to me. They're sort of in the midlife range of things. You know, they've been in their career for 20 years or something, and they're feeling like they're on that hamster wheel, and they've done everything right, but all they're doing is going around. This is how I became the pilgrim. I loved my job. I was very good at my job, but it was something of a hamster wheel. I made it a very exciting hamster wheel by working and living in Europe and traveling all over, but still, it was a hamster wheel. And I found this life, it works for me. Everyone's got to go and figure out their own way of doing things. I don't think my lifestyle is suitable for very many people because I don't have a family. You couldn't do this if you have a family. You can't say, honey, I love you. I'm going away for 6 months. I'm not going to call, but good luck. You know, that's not a family life. Same with the kids. You know, don't forget to take the dog out and bye. That's not a family life. So what I do is not for families. So it takes, and then I have so many skills with regard to things like orienteering and navigation and competence in many different languages and not being concerned. If I'm in an absolute state of confusion, which I often am, I don't let it get me down. I can survive very comfortably in a confusing atmosphere. I just get on with my own thing. I don't get distracted by these things. And the men with guns, really, instead of frightening me, they just annoy me. So, you know, I'm not afraid to say to young soldiers of the world who are conscripted soldiers, 19 years old, patrolling through the forest, they're not trained in what do you do when you see a little woman coming with a backpack through the forest unexpectedly. They're not trained in me, but I know this. And I have enough experience in life, enough savvy, to stand there in front of them, hands on hips, wagging my finger in front of them. Young man, you will point that gun in another direction. I won't have this. There's no threat to you here. Now behave yourself. You, call your commanding officer. We're going to go see him. You, take my bag. Let's go. And they say, yes, ma'am. if you don't have the savvy, the confidence, the, you know, the strength of character to scold a young soldier the way he should be scolded, like his mother. You have to be, for a woman, I think you have to be at least as old as the soldier's mothers, or you won't succeed as a pilgrim. But you also have to have sort of the cockiness to get up to someone and say things like that. It's not for everyone. It's a very, what I do, how I interpret pilgrimage, is for a very small margin of people, I think. But it's not to say only my character person can be a pilgrimage, a pilgrim. You have to figure out your own. Do it. Don't be afraid.
In the off 6 months, what do you do? How do you survive when you're not on a pilgrimage like this?
In general, it's not been a problem. I accept donations. People give me small donations. In the Denver area, I do know a lot of people, and people will say, oh, you want to house it for me for 3 weeks as we go off on vacation. And, you know, so I get by. And small donations just for food. People would give me, like, a gift card to Whole Foods or something like this, just a small one. You know, just something that I need and is consumable now. You know, it's just these little things. I can't even say that there's anything regular or routine. But part of my pilgrim life, and coming up the week after next, I'm flying to Europe, to Rome, to meet four young men who are discerning religious life, and I will lead them on pilgrimage to Krakow. So in this way, it's sort of an off-season thing for me. It is a pilgrimage, but for me, I'm the guide of these other pilgrims. So they've paid for my plane ticket to get over there. And we'll all be mendicant on the way, and then they'll pay for my transportation back to the U.S. So that's taken care of. So little things like this. And my bar is so low. I really don't make many demands. And then I get what I need, and I don't need much. So it just works out. But I don't work. I have made a personal decision to denounce material possession. I don't own a house. I don't own a car. I don't own a bicycle. I own my pilgrim clothes and some extra pilgrim clothes, everyone who knows me now, I wear a green, high visibility green top and a dirt hiding black skirt. So I always wear the same kinds of clothes. I don't worry about it. I can go off on pilgrimage at any time. I never have to get up in the morning and think, ooh, what do I want to wear today? I am myself, in discerning religious life, I've already discerned it. Now we're in the process of forming a Catholic Association of Pilgrims, Servant Pilgrims, and I'm in the process of being consecrated as in the Catholic faith as a pilgrim, which hasn't been done before, so it's a little bit groundbreaking, but we're on that process, and it's going to take the amount of time it's going to take. So no material possessions, poverty, chastity, obedience, the standard Catholic consecrated person's vow.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. This is a very inspiring life. I think it inspires all of us to kind of take a deeper look at our own lives. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Nipom. Thank you, Anne, for taking us on this pilgrimage through your words of wisdom this morning. And there are lots of online comments that we don't have time to, but they are so inspired by listening to your words and inspired for their own life. And so as we usually ask our guests the last question, how can the service based, the larger community serve you on your mission? How can we be of service of you?
Well, we do, with the help of Nicole and some others locally here in Denver, we have formed or we have developed this Society of Servant Pilgrims.com. So it's a website. It's in development. We'll try to build it up. Develop this past winter while I was mostly away on pilgrimage, but now I'm taking some time to populate that. So there would be newsletters and updates, and as things develop, as needs arise, just as our pathway becomes more clear, it would be kind of captured there. Societyofservantpilgrims.com.
Thank you so much. And as time is 10:29, and thank you so much for taking us on a journey through vulnerability, trust, and peace. And the peace, as you said, is universal. Thank you for those words.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.